On Ideas, the 1988 Massey Lectures, about media, propaganda, and democracy. A series of 5 talks, one each night this week, divided into 16 sections, including questions from a panel of distinguished Canadian journalists. The Massey Lectures are an annual event on CBC Radio. They began in 1961 and are commissioned by the CBC to present critical work by prominent intellectuals in the humanities, science, and politics. The 1988 Massey Lectures are given by Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. Professor Chomsky has published some 30 books, both in the field of structural linguistics and in the field of political theory. He's especially well known for his analyses of the place of the United States in international affairs. Last month, Pantheon published his latest book, written with co-author Edward Herman. It's called Manufacturing Consent, and it shows how the American mass media, more properly called the elite media, function as a propaganda system in support of American corporations and government. The philosopher Reinhold Niebuhr concluded that ordinary people were hardly capable of understanding the world or acting reasonably without being subjected to a set of what he called necessary illusions, what we'd call propaganda, constructed by the intellectual elites. The system for managing this has turned out to be the mass media. In tonight's lecture, Noam Chomsky details the treatment by the American Free Press of U.S. actions in Central America, distinguishing between the treatment afforded official enemies, notably Nicaragua, and official U.S. friends, notably Guatemala and El Salvador, the fledgling democracies, as they're called. Professor Chomsky will also examine the reporting of events at the United Nations when the United States disagrees with the rest of the world, a topic of some interest right now, with the activities this week in Washington, New York, and Geneva. The 1988 Massey Lectures on Media, Propaganda, and Democracy. Part 11, on the media as adjuncts of government. Noam Chomsky.
Many of our prominent newspapers have become almost agents or adjuncts of the government. They do not contest or even raise questions about government policy. This is Senator William Fulbright speaking in the United States Senate hearings on government and the media in 1966. These remarks are not precisely accurate. The media do contest and raise questions about government policy, but almost exclusively within the framework determined by the essentially shared interests of state and corporate power. Discussion outside these boundaries is rare, and it's the goals themselves that remain beyond challenge or even awareness. To illustrate, I have reviewed a few samples of the media's contributions on the one hand to the U.S. government project of demonizing the Sandinistas, while on the other hand praising the violent terror states backed or directly installed by the United States in the Central America region. With all the skepticism about the media that I have personally developed through studying their performance over many years, I had not expected that they would rise to the challenge of demonizing the Sandinistas while praising the terror states. But my assessment of the media was naive. Within a year, they had succeeded in portraying the murderous U.S. clients as progressive, if flawed, democracies, while the Sandinistas, guilty of no crime that even begins to approach those of Washington's favorites, had become the very embodiment of evil. The review in my last lecture of 2 periods of intense debate over U.S. policy towards Nicaragua, kept to the spectrum of expressible opinion by editorialists, columnists, or invited contributors. News reporting conforms to the same implicit premises. Jack Spence has studied 181 New York Times articles on Nicaragua during the first 6 months of 1986. The conclusions are similar to those drawn from the editorial and opinion columns. Spence observes that Central America was virtually ignored until U.S. control faced a challenge in 1978. From 1969 through 1977, the TV networks devoted a total of 1 hour to Nicaragua, all on the 1972 earthquake. They ignored the 1972 election in El Salvador, which was overturned by blatant fraud and intervention by the U.S. clients in Central America. That guaranteed the military rule that continues until the present. There being no challenge to U.S. nomination, the problem of establishing democracy did not arise. Similarly, it did not arise in 1984 in Panama, when the notorious drug dealer General Noriega, who was then still a U.S. favorite, ran a fraudulent election, legitimized by the attendance of George Shultz at the inauguration. At the inauguration, Shultz praised the vote as a triumph for democracy, taunting Nicaragua to do the same after he had been briefed by the CIA that Noriega had stolen upwards of 50,000 ballots in order to ensure the election of his candidates. Most of the 181 New York Times stories on Nicaragua came from Washington, and they presented Reagan administration doctrine without challenge or analysis, including the laments about freedom fighters forced to fight with only boots and bandages against advanced Soviet armaments and Cuban-piloted helicopters, brutal repression in what George Shultz called this cancer right here on our landmass, Cuban troops swarming the streets of Managua by the scores in this terrorism sanctuary 2 days' drive from Texas, a second Libya, and so on, through the familiar litany of misrepresentation and outright lies. In the news columns, Spence observes, the Times tacitly accepted the Reaganite views, seeking out no others, thus contributing to a drastic narrowing for public debate. Regarding the charges leveled against the Sandinistas, he goes on, almost no contrary view could be found in the New York Times, and supporting evidence was never present. 4 times in the 181 stories, the Nicaraguan embassy was given a buried line or two, and in a few stories, the reporter added a background balance line. Spence goes on to say it was as if the Times had a software program that at rare and odd intervals automatically kicked in a boilerplate balancing graph beyond that story's halfway point. First priority in news reporting was given to the U.S. government. Ranking second were the U.S. proxy forces, the Contras. There were extensive reports of the concern of the Businessmen's Association, COSEP, harassment of the U.S.-funded journal La Prensa, and other abuses. Coverage of the U.S. clients was largely favorable. Only one of 33 stories on the Contras focused on human rights abuses, and there were a few other references to atrocities that were by that time reaching a remarkable scale. Like the State Department and Congress, the media preferred what human rights investigators described as intentional ignorance. In the case of El Salvador, in contrast, the guerrillas were castigated as Marxist terrorists, and the official line, as laid forth in New York Times editorials, was that things were improving under the democratic government of the Honorable Mr. Duarte, the honest, reform-minded Christian Democrat who is desperately trying to lead his people to a better life while beset by implacable extremes, although the Times concedes he may have been less than rigorous in bringing death squad operatives to judicial account. To translate from the party line to English, Duarte has done nothing to curb the security forces that he praises for their valiant service alongside the people against subversion, his words, while he concedes quietly that the masses were with the guerrillas when he became the front man for the war against the population. Duarte was portrayed as a victim, not as the willing agent whose role was to ensure adequate congressional funding for the state terrorists whom he protected. In its editorials, the Times never once mentioned such matters as the murder of the archbishop with the complicity of the security forces, the destruction and closure of the university by the army with many killed, the physical destruction of the independent media and the murder and expulsion of its editors, or the Salvadoran state of siege from March 1980 when Duarte joined the junta under which the atrocities were conducted with his backing and constant apologetics. In contrast, when Nicaragua declared a state of siege on October 15, 1985, The Times bitterly condemned this demonstration of Nicaragua's lack of respect for democracy and human rights, as they put it, dismissing with contempt President Ortega's claim that the crackdown is the fault of, quote, the brutal aggression by North America and its internal allies. The renewal of El Salvador's far more draconian state of siege 2 days later received no mention whatsoever. These events were also largely suppressed or falsified in the news columns. There was no concern and little, if any, reporting on the fact that since 1981, the Salvadoran press has either supported the government or criticized it from a right-wing perspective, avoiding stories critical of government forces from a human rights standpoint, as observed in an America's Watch review of Freedom of the Press. The political opposition had been murdered by Duarte's security forces or had been driven out of the country, so there was no need to report or comment on their problems, or on the fact that one of the leading murderers became Duarte's respected Minister of Defense after his service as Director of the National Guard as it administered its pedagogy of terror. With regard to Nicaragua, the typical pattern of media coverage was for the U.S. government propaganda services to concoct some charge, which the media would then prominently and uncritically relay. Occasionally, when the charges were seen to be outlandish, there might be a mild disclaimer on the inside pages. Often the charges persisted, even when acknowledged to be groundless or even sheer fabrication. The disgrace of the free press could hardly be more dramatic. It is worth stressing that far more is at issue here than dereliction of duty, incompetence, or service to power. The protection afforded state terrorists in the fledgling democracies provides a veil behind which they can pursue their atrocities with crucial U.S. support, while the indignant focus on far lesser abuses in Nicaragua has facilitated the Reagan programs of terror and economic warfare that reversed social and economic progress in Nicaragua and reduced the economy to ruins, permitting regular media gloating over Sandinista incompetence and malevolence. The media were thus accomplices in an extraordinary outburst of violence and repression. Jack Spence observes that the obviously relevant pending World Court decision was not mentioned in the 171 New York Times news stories that preceded the World Court decision itself. The decision was on June 27, 1986. In this decision, the court condemned the United States for support for the Contras and ordered it to desist from these violations of international law and valid treaties and to pay reparations. The decision was reported, but it was dismissed as a minor annoyance. Its contents were suppressed or falsified. The World Court, not the United States, was portrayed as the criminal, and the rule of law was held to be inapplicable to the United States. In its editorial response to the court decision on July 1st, the New York Times dismissed the court as a hostile forum. They had voiced no criticism when this same hostile forum had ruled in favor of the United States in the matter of the Iran hostage crisis. In a July 17th op-ed column, Thomas Frank of New York University Law School, a noted advocate of world order, argued that the United States should dismiss the World Court ruling because, in his words, America still needs the freedom to protect freedom. The U.S. government and the media are surpassed by none in their appeals to the august rule of law and the call for diplomacy rather than violence, in the case of official enemies, that is. Hence, the events of the summer of 1986 called for some careful perception management. Until June, Nicaragua's failure to accept the Contadora treaty draft was a major story. In May, the New York Times published a lengthy report by Stephen Kinzer, headlined "Nicaragua Balks at Latin Peace Accord." The story criticized Ortega for his unwillingness to sign the agreement without some commitment from the United States. "Nicaragua appears to be the only Central American nation reluctant to sign the draft agreement," Kinzer wrote. A few weeks later, in mid-June, the U.S. client states rejected the treaty draft under U.S. pressure. This fact was excluded from the national press. Nicaragua declared its readiness to sign the treaty on June 21st. The Washington Post ignored the unwelcome fact, but it received oblique mention in two tiny items in the New York Times under the headings, Nicaragua makes offer to limit some weapons, U.S. condemns offer by Nicaragua on treaty. The story focused on the Reagan administration rejection of Nicaragua's acceptance of the treaty as propagandistic. Both items appeared in the Around the World roundup of marginal news. For adjuncts of government, news value is determined by utility for ideological warfare. A few days later, the World Court called for termination of U.S. aid to the Contras. Congress reacted by voting $100 million of military aid to implement what the court had called the unlawful use of force, while government officials commented happily that this is for real, this is a real war. Nicaragua brought the matter to the UN Security Council, where the United States vetoed a resolution calling on all states to observe international law. Nicaragua then turned to the General Assembly of the United Nations, which passed a resolution, 94-3, calling for compliance with the World Court ruling. Two client states, Israel and El Salvador, joined the United States in opposition. The Security Council vote merited a brief note in the New York Times, the newspaper of record, but the General Assembly endorsement of it passed unmentioned. The Times UN correspondent preferred a story that day on overly high UN salaries. In November 1987, a year later, the General Assembly again called for full and immediate compliance with the World Court decision. This time, only Israel joined with the United States in opposing adherence to international law. This was not reported by the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the three TV networks. The reaction of the U.S. government and the media to world opinion merits further comment. The same UN session provides a number of interesting examples. While all attention was focused on the Washington summit in December 1987 and the INF Treaty, the UN voted on a series of disarmament resolutions. The General Assembly voted 154-1 with no abstentions, opposing the buildup of weapons in outer space. That resolution was clearly aimed at Reagan's Star Wars. It voted 135-1 against developing new weapons of mass destruction. In both cases, the United States was alone in opposition. The United States was joined by France in opposing a resolution passed 143-2 calling for a comprehensive test ban treaty. Another vote, calling for a halt to all nuclear test explosions, passed by a vote of 137-3, with the United States joined by France and Britain in opposition. All of these votes were unreported and unmentioned in the New York Times review that was headlined Setbacks to U.S. and Soviet at the United Nations. Other reports on the same session provide further insight into the style of UN coverage. 2 days after the unreported disarmament resolutions, a New York Times story reports a vote on a resolution that, I'm quoting, that reaffirms the United Nations' previous strong condemnation of international terrorism in all its forms and calls on all countries to cooperate in eradicating terrorism. The resolution passed 128-1, Israel alone in opposition, with the United States abstaining and the other 128 members present voting in favor. The headline reads, Syria, isolated at UN, drops terrorism plan. 5 days later, the General Assembly passed a resolution condemning terrorism wherever and by whomever committed. The vote was 153-2, Israel and the United States in opposition, with Honduras alone abstaining. This was unreported and unmentioned in the New York Times review of the session on December 26th. A March 1988 story is headlined, UN to Study Rights in Cuba, U.S. Sees Diplomatic Victory. The story reports Cuba's invitation to the UN Human Rights Commission for an on-the-scene investigation, undercutting a U.S. campaign for a resolution condemning Cuba. The first 13 paragraphs of the story present the U.S. point of view, turning the failure into a great triumph of American diplomacy. The last paragraph quotes a Cuban official who states that the outcome shows our continent's growing political unity in rejecting the U.S. effort. Unreported is a resolution passed by the Human Rights Commission the same day, 26-1, with the United States alone in opposition, expressing grave concern at, quote, the continuation of acts of aggression and the arbitrary practices of the Israeli occupation forces in southern Lebanon, which constitutes a flagrant violation of international law, and calling on Israel's allies to pressure it to end its aggressive and expansionist policy in southern Lebanon. World opinion must pass through the same filters that set the bounds of respectability at home. Failing to meet these standards, world opinion is ignored or subjected to puzzled inquiry as to why the world is out of step.
The 1988 Massey Lectures continue on ideas, presented by Noam Chomsky. Part 12, the Contadora Peace Accords.
Returning to the campaign to demonize the Sandinistas, a new challenge arose when the Central American presidents reached a peace agreement in August 1987. The Reagan administration had long sought to undercut diplomatic initiatives. After bitterly condemning the Sandinistas for refusing to sign the Contadora draft of 1984, the administration quickly changed its tune when Nicaragua unexpectedly announced that it would sign. At that point, the draft became a deception and a fraud, and the United States proceeded to undermine it with further denunciations of the treacherous Sandinistas. Washington tried by all means available to block the signing of the Contadora Peace Act. The Vice Foreign Affairs Minister of Costa Rica observed in an unreported interview, reviewing how the U.S. strongly pressured Costa Rica and its client states during the 1985-1986 period when he was a first-hand witness. The Arias initiatives of 1987 were also most unwelcome to the Reagan administration. In June, Philip Habib, who's called Washington's peace emissary, informed high-ranking senators that if the administration felt its views and interests were not reflected in a regional arrangement, it would continue to fund the Nicaraguan Contra rebels despite agreements reached by the Central American leaders. That was an advance notice that elicited little attention. In the same month, the Reagan administration pressured President Duarte to block a scheduled meeting of Central American presidents in Guatemala. A Guatemalan official reported that Duarte personally told Guatemala's president the reason he asked for a postponement was because of U.S. pressure applied by Habib. In a last-ditch effort to undermine the peace agreement, Washington put forth the Reagan-Wright plan on August 5th. This plan called for dismantling the political system in Nicaragua, an end to arms aid to Nicaragua, and demobilization of its military forces. In return, the United States would pledge to halt shipments of arms to the Contras. This proposal received wide media acclaim as fair and just. Nevertheless, to the surprise and annoyance of the administration, the Central American presidents reached an agreement on August 7th. Government propaganda then shifted, predictably, to the demolition of the unacceptable accords. The media followed faithfully along. The first requirement of this most remarkable campaign was to establish that U.S. support for the Contras forced the Sandinistas to negotiate. This is an important doctrine, since it can be exploited to justify subsequent resort to armed force and terror. The doctrine hardly withstands the evidence of history. This evidence reveals Nicaragua's effort to pursue the peaceful means required by international law through the World Court, the United Nations, and the Contadora process, and on the other hand, Washington's success in trumping these initiatives, as a leaked secret document exalted. Such problems were readily overcome by dismissal of the facts to the memory hole. The next problem was to dismantle the accords themselves. The first phase of the accords ran from the signing in August 1987 to January 1988, when the Central American presidents were to meet to receive the report of the International Verification Commission that was charged with monitoring the accords. The goal of the Reagan administration was to focus all attention on the Sandinistas, thus ensuring that the United States could maintain the attack by its proxy forces while excluding the U.S. client states from the provisions of the accords. The media at once dedicated themselves to these tasks. The peace plan specified one indispensable element for peace, namely, a termination of open or covert aid of any form to irregular forces, meaning the Contras, or insurrectionist movements, meaning indigenous guerrillas. In response, the United States at once stepped up its illegal supply flights, which had already reached the phenomenal level of one a day, in an effort to keep the proxy forces in the field. These supply flights doubled in September, the month after the accords, and virtually tripled through the rest of the year. Surveillance flights also increased. Successes were immediately evident as Contra attacks on civilians doubled in intensity, including ambushes, murders, attacks on farm cooperatives, and kidnappings. The peace agreements were thus effectively dead from the first moment. These were, by far, the most significant developments during the August-January phase of the accords. The media responded to these unacceptable facts by suppressing them. Only the most assiduous reader of all of the media, unpublished wire service reports, and other documents could have been minimally aware of these crucial facts. The behavior of the New York Times was particularly remarkable, including outright falsification along with scrupulous suppression. Again, we see a shocking display of media servility to state power.